Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the upcoming choice facing the Democratic Party in next Saturday's election of a chairman of the DNC, which may determine the fate of political opposition in the country as a groundswell of resistance to the new Trump administration is erupting across the country and around the world. Steve Phillips, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author of Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority, joins us to discuss his article in today's New York Times, Move Left Democrats. He is the founder of Democracy in Color, and we'll examine the fact that in the last election, more Obama voters defected to the Green and Libertarian parties than was the increase in the number of white working class voters who supported Donald Trump, with Hillary Clinton getting 193,000 fewer white voters in Wisconsin, for example, compared to Obama than Trump, who picked up just 9,000 more white voters than Romney did. We will assess whether the election of an African-American Muslim, Congressman Keith Ellison, will steer the Democrats away from pursuing the wrong white voters in the Rust Belt to instead focus on the growing opportunities in the South and West. Then we'll speak with Kamal Esaheb, who is an immigration policy attorney at the National Immigration Law Center, whose advocacy focuses on the DREAM Act and DACA. We will examine the memorandums released today by the Department of Homeland Security that appear to declare open season on the deportation of undocumented immigrants and discuss the deputizing of local police and sheriffs that, in effect, will nationalize the infamous Arizona Sheriff Arpaio's enforcement approach to immigration reform. Then finally, we'll look into the human rights dimensions of this change in America's attitude and approach to immigrants and speak with Maria McFarland Sanchez Moreno, the co-director of the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch, about whether Trump's impending roundup will become a referendum on America's decency and humanity, and also assess the extent to which Donald Trump is a threat to American democracy itself with his increasing preference for patriotic political rallies favored by autocrats that whip up crowds with populist fervor, which often scapegoats so-called enemies of the people. And joining us now is Steve Phillips, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the founder of Democracy in Color, a national political leader and civil rights lawyer. He's the author of the New York Times and Washington Post bestseller, Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. And he has an article at the New York Times, Move Left Democrats. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Phillips.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us, Stephen. And do you think that if indeed the Democratic Party or the DNC elect Keith Ellison, that they will move away from pursuing the wrong white people? Because most of the postmortems that I've been discussing with the Democratic strategists about the elections really missed the point. And it seems for the first time I've noticed somebody get the point, which is what you're saying, is that let's not wring our hands over losing the white working class voters to Trump. Let's focus on the voters we really lost, which were the voters that supported Jill Stein and the Libertarians.
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely correct that most of the analysis, almost all of it to date, has been about how do we get back the voters who voted for Trump. And there's a real, you know, almost like knee-jerk, reflexive obsession with trying to figure out, which really goes back, you know, 30-plus years to the whole efforts around getting back the Reagan Democrats and then the soccer moms in the 90s. And so there's this reflexive default position around trying to get back those more conservative working-class white voters, rather than realizing that there are a meaningful enough number to have won who are more progressive and who are alienated and dispirited and defected not to Trump, but over to Johnson and Stein. The numbers of people who voted for them, their increase in the third and fourth party vote, was larger than the increase in the vote that was for Trump. And that's a, you know, essential missing element in the post-election analysis.
And the broader statistic is that in 2008, 9 million more Democrats or people voted Democrat for Obama and then they did for Hillary Clinton and in the last election. And then in the more recent 2012, I think it was 7 million more Democrats voted than did for Hillary Clinton. Is that right?
Well, actually, no. There were more voters in 2008, and then Obama actually got fewer votes in 2012. Mm-hmm. But the increase in the third and fourth party vote was around 7 million votes, where it had only been around 2 million before in 2012. There was a large groundswell of folks either thinking she had it or it didn't matter or they weren't inspired by her who gravitated to that direction. So they were not Trump voters, not responding to the, you know, the racist and sexist and conservative appeal of Trump. They were actually just not motivated to gravitate towards the Democrats.
But we're only talking at the end of the day, in spite of Donald Trump's rhetoric about this massive Electoral College victory, where he appears to be operating with alternative facts, and it's pretty hard to permeate that, although a reporter did point it out to him at the last press conference, and then he blamed it on his staff. That's what I was told. But the bottom line is only Hillary Clinton essentially lost the election by 77,744 votes, and that, and she of course won the popular vote by about 3 million. Rather than relitigate the antiquated electoral college system, what is then the choice going forward here? This country desperately needs an opposition. It feels like the Democrats in disarray. But on the other hand, there's been this spontaneous eruption of demonstrations on the very day after Trump's inauguration. Millions of women marched in cities across the country and around the world, and there have been many demonstrations since. So I think at this point you could fairly say we are in an unusual political condition where you have a lot of political energy on the left in search of strategy.
Right, right. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it's critical to remember that this is, you know, many people feel an illegitimate presidency, but certainly mathematically not a representative of the majority of people in the country. So for the third election in a row, the Democrats got the majority of the voters in the country. And but for this really quirk in those three states by, you know, 78,000 votes, we wouldn't be facing this problem. So it's just critical not to overreact in terms of trying to, you know, gravitate in that direction. But the enthusiasm, the activism, the resistance is incredibly impressive and inspiring, and is the type of thing that's necessary. And we need to be able to make sure we focus it and channel it in strategic ways that are going to help us build back power. Right? There's 10 states we lost by single digits. And so what are we doing to build capacity in those states to be able to increase our vote there and be able to manifest the full majority that we do represent within the country?
And again, I'm speaking with Steve Phillips, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the founder of Democracy in Color, a national political leader and civil rights lawyer. He is the author of the New York Times and Washington Post bestseller, Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority, and he has an article at the New York Times, Move Left Democrats. So now we have a situation where, as I mentioned in the opening, on Saturday there's this vote at the DNC to choose a new chairman of the DNC and effectively the leader of the Democratic Party. And the idea that the front runner, at least one of the front runners, is Keith Ellison, who is a African American congressman and a Muslim. What's your sense of that in terms of Tom Perez, who is the former Secretary of Labor, as the two choices? Is there a choice there in terms of those that get it, in terms of your article, or are they both sort of similarly good choices, if that's the best way to put it?
Yeah, I think they're both strong choices and positive steps in the right direction, right? And to have either, like you're saying, an African-American Muslim at the face of the party, or to have a Latino man at the face of the party reflect this new American majority, which is much more diverse and much more inclusive. And both of them have track record. I mean, Keith has done a really excellent job of increasing voter participation, engaging in his district, African immigrants and Latinos and progressive whites, and increasing the turnout each year he's been within Congress. Then Tom has put together a very impressive team where he has people, you know, such as, you know, Emmy Ruiz, who ran Colorado and delivered that for Clinton, ran Nevada and delivered that for her in the primary, who are backing his team. So they have around them, and they represent the right direction for the party. There are going to be a lot of pressure from other sources, and a lot of the donors and the conventional wisdom around, well, we've got to get the Trump voters, which means we have to be more conservative. So that's the tension, which is partly why I wanted to write the article, is to draw attention to that debate, and to make sure that whoever prevails for the party chair sticks to his or her guns around being able to move the party in the direction in which the country is heading.
But will there be a backlash amongst the donors? For example, Haim Saban, who's a big donor, I think hasn't he said some disparaging things about Keith Ellison in relation to support for Israel?
He has, and I think that's, you know, frankly, one of the challenges that the party has had. I mean, how do you get to a situation where, you know, this New York billionaire becomes seen as the champion of the working class? And so to the extent you can strip away his, you know, racist and nationalist appeal, the Democrats have not done enough to make it crystal clear that they are the populist party, the party around of working people and people who are disenfranchised. And part of that is because they frequently moderate their language and mute their calls to action because of fear of alienating the big donors. But if there's one thing that is indisputable about the effect of Bernie Sanders' campaign, is he raised $230 million. In, as you were saying, $27, $28 increments. And so you don't have to be dependent upon the big billionaire donors in order to fund a political campaign. And that's going to be a critical lesson for the next party leader to implement as well.
Yeah, but you have to, I mean, Bernie, first of all, is not a Democrat, although he caucuses with the Democrats. And he's you know, in his 70s, I think he's the same age as Trump, is he, if not a little older?
Yeah, so I'm not saying Bernie per se either way. I'm just saying that.
Well, but who is the new Bernie Sanders? I mean, my problem with the Democrats is that they've all, and like many people, I think, they think that you punch your ticket for democracy every 2 or 4 years,
right,
and then the man on the white horse you elect, then you don't have to show up. You know, you don't have to even show up for the midterms. Remember Obama said, yes, we can. He didn't say, yes, I can. But
right,
the criticism of Obama from the political left in the Democratic Party was that he didn't deliver. Well, you know, it works both ways.
Right.
People have to work. And Bernie Sanders has shown that there's this massive constituency of young people who are the future of both the party, if they're smart enough, and the country. So the writing's on the wall, isn't it?
Yes. So I think the party is going to have to get much more responsive to that real hunger and thirst for social change and for far-reaching social change. And so, and to not just default to the traditional spending approach of waiting till 6 weeks before the election and then running TV ads. We need to be on the ground, organizing, talking to people year-round, and not just every few years. And that is what Keith Ellison's track record has been. So I do think he will move the party much more in that direction.
But do you think that the Democrats will stop asking for money, because that's all I ever get, is just more and more solicitations for money, particularly from the DNC? And you know, obviously, there's a dependence on the donor class, and obviously the Republicans, since Citizens United, that was the greatest gift to the Republicans, the Chief Justice handing them that blank check from corporate America and from billionaires. So they've got a huge advantage there. But my sense has always been that, you know, if you keep asking people for money, What about all those young people that Bernie brought out? They don't have money. They're in debt to student loans. But what they've got is a lot of energy and a lot of ideas. So why not harness that? Why just rely on the money race?
Right. Well, that's been the traditional playbook, but as you saw, clearly that doesn't work. And so the advantage of this moment where there is so much energy and activism is to get that channeled into the kinds of block-by-block, neighborhood-by-neighborhood organizing that's essential for social change in general and winning political elections in particular. And that really needs to be the mandate for the next party chair.
But it has to go beyond the election itself, doesn't it, in terms of translating into getting people into office that will carry out the agendas of those that voted for them. In other words, be a lot more responsive to the grassroots and the young people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so that's where it can't just be about party or party without content behind it. And so, you know, Trump is waging war on immigrants in a country built on and consisting almost entirely of immigrants, with the exception of the Native American population. And so what's the posture and position and role and voice that the Democrats are going to have in this context? They're going to put their voices and their bodies on the line to stop this really, almost fascistic approach of what Trump is moving forward. And so they're going to have to take actions that will then be seen and felt as making clear whose side they are on. Are they going to put forward proposals to actually tax the top 1% to meet the needs and lift everyone and address economic inequality? Those are the types of positions that the party needs to start articulating in order to channel this energy that's out there in ways that can help win elections.
Well, you know, it's always been a case of the enthusiasm gap. The Democrats have a natural majority. There are more average working people and middle-class people in this country than there are rich people and members of the Chambers of Commerce. But somehow the Republicans get all their people to vote and manage to encourage some working-class Democratic voters to vote for them as well. But where it feels like we're in a different era now or different moment with so much political energy out there that it's almost like the Democratic Party and Democratic representatives in both the House and Senate are kind of playing catch-up to their own grassroots.
Yeah, no, I think that that's true. And I think that it is what we saw. You're saying there was a lot of enthusiasm and excitement around Bernie's campaign. And at the end of the day, this, you know, for better or worse in terms of the there were strengths and weaknesses to Clinton's campaign, but at the end of the day, there was not the enthusiasm, particularly in those three states, to be able to carry her over the finish line. And so that's something people have to take to heart and think about: how does the agenda resonate with the conditions and the experiences people are feeling on the ground and on the streets?
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Steve Phillips.
Thanks for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Steve Phillips, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the founder of Democracy in Color, a national political leader and civil rights lawyer. He is the author of the New York Times and Washington Post bestseller, Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. And he has an article at the New York Times, Move Left, Democrats. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the immigration changes coming forth today from the Department of Homeland Security that appear to declare open season on the deportation of undocumented immigrants.
To send someone away, got my back covered. how you've been all led astray. Come, let's count its ups. They lead you to the race, but no one's asked them to.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Kamal Esaheb, who is an immigration policy attorney at the National Immigration Law Center, who engages in advocacy and technical assistance relating to state and local enforcement of immigration law and access to legal status for immigrants. His advocacy focuses on passage of the DREAM Act, implementation of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA program, and state and local enforcement of immigration law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kamal Esaheb.
Thank you for having me.
And Kamal, what do you make of the memorandums released today by the Department of Homeland Security? Many people are saying that they appear to declare open season on the deportation of undocumented immigrants.
Well, we certainly read it that way. I mean, this is Trump's blueprint for mass deportation that he's been talking about. This basically says, the memos released today basically say that anybody at any moment who's here without permission can be picked up and can be deported, no matter how long they've been here, no matter what their roots in the community, no matter whether they have a business or American children. We're turning to a dark page or a dark chapter in terms of how we treat immigrants in this country.
So the idea that Trump has said on a couple of occasions that he's not going to go after the dreamers, that he loves kids, he said the other day, and that he doesn't want to deport the dreamers. But it sounds like he's perfectly happy to deport their parents.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to make of his comments. He keeps talking about, first of all, he hasn't definitively said whether he's going to keep the DACA program. And that's the program that President Obama created to protect dreamers from deportation. He hasn't said that. All he's talked about is, how much he loves kids and loves this population. And I think today he said that, they're going to be taken care of. I don't know how you take care of kids when you deport their parents. I don't know how you're going to take care of kids when, you put their parents in a position where they have to think twice about going to the hospital or, going to the grocery store. So I'm not quite sure I follow the logic there. I understand that the dreamer population is sympathetic, but the reality is, people live in mixed status families. People live in families where there's a citizen child and a dreamer child with DACA and undocumented parents and uncles with green cards. These are not, people who are just, segmented from the rest of society. So when you really talk about showing heart, as the president has done, you don't do that by, protecting one member of the family and, putting another member of family of, fear of imminent deportation.
Well, one of the memos that came out today from the DHS is directing ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to hire 10,000 additional people to do this job. And the job itself is not entirely enunciated, but it does sound like that's the army that you need to deport, up to 11 million people.
Right. I mean, they'll need Congress for that. They'll need Congress to appropriate the money for that. And I think the question for Congress is going to be, how long are we going to let this, chaos go on? I mean, we saw how when the Muslim ban was implemented, the chaos and at the airports and the inhumanity of people, separated from loved ones who are traveling, across the world and not being able to see one another. I mean, I believe that we're going to see a similar dynamic when today's memos are fully implemented. And the question for Congress is Congress going to rein in that chaos and rein in this administration and exercise some oversight over this president and how he conducts immigration policy, or is Congress going to, you know, bankroll it and pay for, you know, 10,000 more officers, you know, to roam the streets and terrorize immigrant communities?
And again, I'm speaking with Kamal Esaheb, who's an immigration policy attorney at the National Immigration Law Center, who engages in advocacy and technical assistance relating to state and local enforcement of immigration law and access to legal status for immigrants. His advocacy focuses on passage of the DREAM Act, implementation of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA program, and state and local enforcement of immigration law. But one of the other aspects of this, these memos from DHS that has gotten a lot of people's attention and alarmed a lot of people is the idea of deputizing local police and sheriffs to serve as immigration agents. And most people see that inexorably leading to racial profiling and civil rights violations. And there's also... it's almost in effect following the playbook of the infamous Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who, by the way, was recently defeated in his re-election bid. But we know that Donald Trump loves Sheriff Joe. He loves Sheriff Joe as much as he loves these DACA kids.
Yeah, well, he wants to nationalize, you know, the program that Joe Arpaio made famous, this so-called 287G program, which essentially gives local cops immigration enforcement authority. And what we've seen when you have that program in place is, kind of program in place, is two things. We saw two things happen in Maricopa County, Arizona, where Joe Arpaio is from. We saw that, you know, there was rampant racial profiling. You know, sometimes when you tell cops to look for somebody who doesn't have immigration status, they look for somebody who looks Latino. So we saw that, and there was a, you know, Department of Justice investigation and a court ruling that found that. And then you see that not only does it cost the county a lot of money, but all indicators of public safety go down. And you saw that in Maricopa County. There was a report by the Goldwater Institute, which is a conservative think tank, that basically looked at what happened in Maricopa County when immigration enforcement went up. What happened when there were more officers engaging in immigration enforcement? And what they found is the budget went up at twice the population growth rate in the county over that period. And they found that all indicators of public safety essentially went down. The murder rate went up. The number of warrants served went down. The number of investigations closed went down. So this isn't... something that's good fiscally. It's not something good from a public safety perspective, and it's something that you know, promotes racial profiling.
Well, this is why a lot of the police chiefs, for example, here in Los Angeles and other major urban centers, most of whom I think are sanctuary cities, they have made that argument over and over again, haven't they? That if you go after a ethnic group or a community of people, then there's no way that you can effectively police that community in terms of crime, because people are just afraid to talk to anybody in a uniform, and therefore you can't have law enforcement working with ICE in the sense that nobody's going to ever open up to the cops about what happened and who did it. And the same is true for this anti-Muslim stuff. You know, if we're worried about self-radicalized, you know, young Muslims sitting in their basement watching jihadi videos and deciding one day to go out and do something crazy like what happened out here in San Bernardino, then the assumption's always been that the first line of defense against that is somebody in the local mosque or in the family or somebody that knows this kid, knows he's going off the rails, and therefore you can intervene before the worst happens. So those are examples that I've heard many times from law enforcement officials, both local police and you know, people like in the FBI and other agencies who deal with domestic terrorism. So it's so obvious, isn't it?
Well, for the people, I mean, the people who no immigrants. That, you know, the people, you know, the elected officials, the police chiefs, who represent communities where immigrants live, like you said, are adopting policies that are promoting the relationship between local police and immigrants, and cops know this better than anyone. You can't solve a crime if the victim is scared to talk to you. You can't solve a crime if the witnesses to the crime, you know, won't talk to you. And so not only are you, if immigrants see the cop and think they're a deportation agent, not only are they going to, not seek help when they need help, but you're going to have a community that's going to be further victimized by criminals who know that they're not going to seek help. So it sets in place a vicious cycle. And I think, you know, we need to take our lessons here from places that know immigrants, places that have immigrants, and you know, across the board, cities like that want nothing to do with immigration policy. They want to promote vibrant immigrant communities, because that's not only good for the immigrant communities, but that's good for the cities as a whole.
Well, it's hard to get a handle on exactly what Trump thinks, because he changes his tune a lot. He also apparently is influenced by what he watches on Fox News. He's likely to say anything, like he did, that referenced something that happened in Sweden that didn't happen. That left a lot of people scratching their heads. But he once said, let's start with this. There are 11 million undocumented immigrants living in the U.S. in 2014. That's based on the Pew Research statistics. Donald Trump hinted that he planned to deport 2 to 3 million people in a 60 Minutes interview in November. We know that the DACA, the program that you worked on, Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals, protects 740,000 DACA recipients. So is there any other protections here in terms of obviously the number itself is a moving target between 11 million and 2. And then on top of that, you've got, 740,000 DACA kids. So are there any other programs that could protect people? I'm trying to get a handle on the number of people in this country who are vulnerable and who in the next few months could be rounded up.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way I look at it is I'm not sure. I mean, I think the limitation I've stopped trying to make sense of their numbers. Let me just put that out there. I've stopped, trying to chase down where they're coming up with their numbers, but at the end of the day, the limitation on how many people are going to be harmed by this deportation machine is how much resources they have. You know, are they going to be able to supersize the deportation force by another 10,000? And that's going to be up to Congress. And there you're going to have people like, Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Leader Mitch McConnell, who are going to have to make a choice. Are they going to go down the Trump path of mass deportation and, trying to separate families, including American families, or are they going to, are they going to show some sanity here and put the brakes on and show some oversight of, a chaotic, incompetent administration?
Well, this chaotic and incompetent administration, one of its centerpieces from the campaign is the wall. And Donald Trump has not backed away from the wall. And estimates are, between 20 and 30 billion. He lowballs it, but anybody that's looked at it seriously sees it between 20 and 30 billion. And if it's ever entertained, it would go down as the biggest waste of money in the history of mankind. It would, rival, whatever vanity projects you can imagine from the pyramids on. So What is that? Is there a possible political deal here? In other words, the Republicans will say, we'll fund your extra 10,000 immigration police, but you know that'll be out of your mythical wall budget. Is that what, so? In other words, my sense is that since the wall is undoable, impractical, and ridiculous, maybe he's using that as a sort of piggy bank that can be tapped to do other things that are actually quite, you know, in many ways arguably worse, because it's, you know, a real deportation of real people is worse than some ridiculous imaginary wall.
Yeah, and I mean, I think one thing to keep in mind is we're already spending almost $20 billion a year on immigration enforcement a year. And to put that in context, that's we spend less than $15 billion on all other federal law enforcement activities combined. That's FBI, that's ATF, DEA, Secret Service. So we're already spending and have been spending, at record numbers, on immigration enforcement. And the idea that we would add $20 billion a year, for the wall or hire 10,000 agents. I mean, think about how many, how much we can improve our public education system, with that money. Think about how many hungry families can be fed with that money. I mean, this is a president that's created a fictional problem. He needed a villain to get elected, and that villain was Mexicans, like he talked about,
and Muslims.
First announced his candidacy.
Yeah,
right. And now, in order to justify the villain that it created, we need to spend tens of billions of dollars of this is taxpayer money, chasing a non-existent problem that. And that money could better be used fundamentally making people's lives better, job training programs, better access to higher education, better public, education for younger kids. But he doesn't want to do that. He would rather go down the path of, vilifying and demonizing a segment of our population.
Well, I guess it's only just beginning, and judging by the spontaneous demonstrations against Donald Trump starting on the first day after his inauguration, there is some sense that the public are going to rise up, and certainly more people have been demonstrating than the 10,000 extra immigration police that Trump's looking to recruit. So I guess we just have to wait and see. What's coming down the pike here, but I imagine for immigrants living in this country, it's got to be awful. That the uncertainty has got to be really, really hard to live with.
Yeah, I mean, these are dark times, and there are families sitting around a dinner table tonight, trying to take it all in, and wondering. Right. How they're going to go about their day-to-day lives in this environment. And, it's going to be a tough road ahead.
Well, Kamal Esaheb, I thank you for joining us here today.
All right. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Kamal Esaheb, who's an immigration policy attorney at the National Immigration Law Center, who engages in advocacy and technical assistance relating to state and local enforcement of immigration laws and access to legal status for immigrants. His advocacy focuses on passage of the DREAM Act, implementation of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals DACA program, and state and local enforcement of immigration law. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the human rights dimensions of this change in America's attitude and approach to immigrants.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the border line. Look at me, I just can't believe what they've done to me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Maria McFarlane Sanchez Moreno, who is the co-director of the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch, where she works on national security, immigration, and criminal justice in the United States, including large-scale surveillance and drug policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Maria McFarlane Sanchez Moreno.
Thanks for having me.
And obviously, the Department of Homeland Security's memorandums released today revealing Donald Trump's intentions in terms of deportation of undocumented immigrants. It does seem in the broadest sense that maybe he'll save the dreamers but arrest their parents. And other guests have suggested that this is really, in a sense, nationalizing Sheriff Arpaio's approach to immigration. How do you see it?
Well, it's absolutely an extremely harsh approach to immigration enforcement. It's using many of the tools that were already at the government's disposal, but taking them to an extreme, not allowing immigrants an opportunity to make the case that they have strong ties to this country, that they have U.S. citizen children or parents here who need them, and eliminating any possibility of due process. So it's a very extreme and kind of showy approach to immigration enforcement that seems to be mainly an effort to pander to his base.
At the expense of the parents of dreamers,
at the expense of the rights of thousands and potentially, if you believe him, millions of people who will not have the chance to make their case that they should be able to stay in the country, and possibly damaging many, many families, tearing them apart.
But doesn't that right go back to about 1902, the idea that you cannot simply be thrown out of this country without a hearing?
So you are supposed to get a hearing. The question is how substantive it's going to be, right? And expedited processing that we've seen happen before is often so quick that it lacks any substance.
So let's, obviously I'm talking to you because I personally see a human rights dimension to this issue of immigration and the possibility of large-scale immigration raids and the idea that law enforcement across the country is being sort of deputized by the national government. And these people, you know, don't necessarily have the training that ICE agents have. And it strikes me as, this is like large-scale human rights abuses waiting to happen.
It could well lead to many other abuses, and also it's bad for security. And that's why many local law enforcement agencies don't want to be involved in immigration enforcement, because it sends a chilling effect throughout immigrant communities who will then be afraid of reporting crimes that they witness or of which they're victims. And that makes it harder for police to do their jobs, which is something that we documented directly, for example, in Nashville, Tennessee, a few years ago, where police did not want to be involved in enforcing immigration law. They saw it as a problem for public safety.
Well, in terms of DACA and the Dreamers, and there are these protections, particularly with DACA and DAPA, are to do entirely with human rights situations, or not entirely, but clearly with the human rights situations, surely in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, do they not? Isn't there a direct connection?
So there's a significant issue with people seeking asylum in the United States. Many of the children who have crossed the border in the last few years, the unaccompanied minors, are fleeing situations of violence and persecution in Central America. And the U.S. has obligations under international law to check to see if they are claiming fear of being returned to their countries. And if so, They need to give them a serious process to see if they want to make a claim for asylum, and if they can make it, then they should be allowed to stay. And the problem with expedited removal is that too often it makes it very difficult to make claims of asylum, among other reasons. DACA is a slightly different situation. It involves children who came, often with parents who crossed the border or came into the country who were undocumented, but the children grew up here, and they know no other home, and it's a matter of fairness to allow them to stay, and frankly, it's to the benefit of the U.S. Many of these children are very successful, promising people who have much to contribute to the country.
So is there any evidence or any way that one can tie the human rights conditions in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras to U.S. foreign policy? I know many people have argued that, but I mean, I'm trying to get to the point of what is our obligation, not just under international law, but under, the basic human conscience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the simplest thing is simply to say that the U.S. has obligations to take in people who are persecuted, legal obligations as well as obligations of principle. And if people are coming to this country seeking refuge because they're being persecuted where they came from, the U.S. should open its doors to them. What role the U.S. has had in Central America, that's very complicated history. And so it's hard to just draw direct lines and saying, well, all of the violence there now is caused by the U.S. I wouldn't say that. It's a very complex relationship, and certainly the U.S. has played a role in the past in Central America and continues to, and the drug trade is a factor in all of this, and the U.S. is certainly part of the international market in drugs. So it's a complex situation, but the U.S. Sending people back to danger is certainly not going to help, and is instead, putting all of the burden on the most vulnerable.
And again, I'm speaking with Maria McMarlon Sanchez Moreno, the co-director of the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch, where she works on national security, immigration, and criminal justice in the United States, including large-scale surveillance and drug policies. Now, the executive director of your organization, Human Rights Watch, Kenneth Roth, has an article in the Huffington Post, We Cannot Afford to Sit Back While Trump Threatens America's Democracy. And he begins by saying, I've spent years defending human rights around the world, but I've never been this worried about the future of the United States. So do you share that disquiet? I mean, do you think that we are, in terms of this fever about immigration, and clearly I think polls indicate the majority of Americans do not recognize we have a broken immigration system. I'm not sure how all of them feel about the idea of starting wholesale roundups and deporting up to 11 million people. Mm-hmm. But in general, is this a referendum on our national conscience, on our decency?
I think the treatment of immigrants does reflect on what the U.S. is, what does it stand for. But the issue of American democracy is broader, and it has to do with the way Trump is treating the media, the way he has spoken about the courts, his disdain for facts, and for what many in the public are saying. The fact is that, like Ken, I've lived and worked abroad, and I've seen autocrats, and the U.S. has no experience with autocracy. And so some of this behavior may not yet upset many Americans in the way it does people who've seen it elsewhere. But I think what we need to be very conscious of is the U.S. does have very strong institutions. It's true that even the bureaucracy within the government is making its views known. And it's true that the courts have held strong. But over time, it is possible to erode these institutions. It has happened elsewhere. And so the time to stand for them and defend them is now.
Well, there's certainly indications of autocracy and of kind of a sympathy with white nationalism. A lot of that's been attributed to Stephen Bannon, Donald Trump's chief strategist. But in terms of the optics, I must say that these rallies, which Donald Trump seems to want to return to, it's almost like Groundhog Day, that he doesn't necessarily like being president, but he's revisiting the moments of his campaigns. It's almost like watching those PBS shows of revivals of groups from the 50s singing their oldies but goodies. You know, there's a strangeness about it, but there's also a whiff of autocracy in terms of the way Cordillos do love to have rallies, and much of we still have to remind ourselves that Trump's campaign began with an ad hominem, apparently random attack on Latinos, calling Mexicans rapists and criminals. And that disturbed a lot of people, and that certainly, the first day out of the gate, raised certain questions. And it clearly was not accidental; it was quite deliberate. So there's a number of aspects of the Trump campaign and extending into the presidency that do raise questions about the idea of a kind of Cordillo, but particularly the one thing that autocrats have in common is they do scapegoat the other, whether in Hitler's case it was the Jews. In this case, it does appear to be immigrants, whether they're Muslims or Mexicans.
Right now, it's very disturbing to watch all of the hateful rhetoric that we're seeing coming out of government officials, but also many of the government supporters, and it's against immigrants, it's against Muslims, but it might not stop there. And as you said, authoritarian leaders, but populists in general, will pick on targets and use their rhetoric about dangers and stoking fear in the public to justify rights abuses. And what the public needs to be very aware of is that once you start justifying the abuses of some people, then rights for all of us are in danger. Once you start allowing that to slip, once you start allowing institutions also to stop working, once the checks of government are no longer as strong as they once were, it can get worse very quickly. So people need to be vigilant. The public needs to be vigilant. Obviously, there's a strong protest movement, and it's not showing signs of going away. But it's also important that officials in government and that Congress exert oversight authority. And that I'm not saying as much. So I think that it's very, very important that people be clear about what's at stake. Senator McCain did give an important speech at Munich a few days ago, but I think we need to see more elected officials speaking out and being very, very clear about what the principles are that they stand for.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Maria McFarlane Sanchez Moreno, if this becomes these Department of Homeland Security memorandums become the new policy of the Donald Trump administration in terms of deportation of undocumented immigrants and effectively declaring open season on immigrants and deputizing local police and sheriffs to serve as immigration agents, all of that is quite alarming. And I dread the idea of watching television. In fact, you know, the daily dose of doom already on television is very hard to take. So if it's going to get more bleak and dark, which this whole situation portends, then it's really going to become intolerable. Where will the pushback come from? My assumption would be, for example, that the Chamber of Commerce types on the Republican side eventually are going to say, wait a minute, we've got nobody to pick our fruits and vegetables and work in our restaurants and on our construction sites. That may take take a while. Where would the immediate pushback come from?
I think that it's important that the public at large stand up for the rights of immigrants. And I don't know if they will, but I think that you are seeing movement in a way that you haven't before, that members of the public are interested in these issues now because they feel that they have an impact on everybody. So I think you might see more pushback. You might see more members of Congress being accosted during town halls this week and being asked tough questions about this. Will that make a difference on its own? I think it's tough. I think you do need other institutions to step in. Fortunately, the courts have done so, and we need to make sure that they feel safe and empowered to continue doing their jobs. But again, I think we need elected officials. We need Congress to speak up. And fortunately, they're also the states, and state governments can do some things to help mitigate some of these problems.
Well, Maria McFarlane Sanchez Moreno, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Maria McFarlane Sanchez Moreno, who's the co-director of the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch, where she works on national security, immigration, and criminal justice in the United States, including large-scale surveillance and drug policy. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.